Today, Job Killer arrives early. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, Wealth Notice Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hello, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad, you know, all things considered.
Hanging in there, eh? And congratulations on the last video. That did very well. And we're going to try and better it this time, I guess.
Fingers crossed, mate.
So, job killer, I think I probably coined that phrase on one of our last posts.
Yeah, you did. And it's quite interesting how things have played out since. You know, we've already seen 120,000 childcare workers being taken off job keeper. There's so many job everythings these days. And you know, I think that's only the beginning. You know, we've got this review coming at the end of the month from Treasury to see what industries need the support and what industries don't. And I think we're going to see more and more people pushed off job keeper onto job seeker, and you know, it's only the beginning of the what are they calling it, the fiscal cliff.
Yeah, and you know, let's just go back over history, right? So originally the expectations were about 6 million people would be supported via job keeper and then they did a reforecast, and it's probably nearer 3 million. I think it could be lower than that still, actually, looking at some of the latest data. So it's had a significant impact. The trouble is, of course, that businesses may well sign up for JobKeeper, get the money, but who's making sure that they've actually passed it on to their employees in the first place, right? Because there's a big question of how that process all works. And I've had a few people report to me that they think they're on JobKeeper, according to their employer, but they haven't necessarily received any money yet. So there's something not quite right there to start with. And as you say, there's now a discussion about how it's going to be turned off, when it's going to be turned off. And in fact, ScoMo was talking at CSA today, and he basically reaffirmed that this was going to be temporary. It was effectively going to go, you know, off later, and as expected. And I think most people in watching politics is suggesting that there may be some limited support beyond September, but not a lot. So that cliff that we spoke about last time, I'll put a link to that previous post, I think is really crucial now. And incidentally, I don't know whether you saw this, but Kohler last week in The Australian wrote also about that other cliff, which is the mortgage repayment holiday cliff, right? Because at the moment, the banks are postponing interest and principal repayments, and there's around 780,000 loans now, according to the ABA, that have been postponed. But of course, that can't be indefinite, and at the moment, that's due to end at the end of September. And there's a question then as to what happens to those loans. Will they get repayment started if people are off JobKeeper and not back at work? How's that going to work? And then the other side of it is, and do banks then have to disclose those loans as bad loans? And if they do, what does that do to their capital ratio? So there's a very complex set of issues here. And the cliff looks more and more precipitous.
Yeah, it was quite interesting seeing what that piece you mentioned in The Australian, you know, talking about, what did Alan Kohler say? That it was going to be almost an unparalleled financial crisis if the mortgage holidays and the fiscal cliff were both allowed to occur at the same time. And it's interesting that yesterday Cookie Boy posted on Twitter about the rise in mortgage arrears even before COVID, and seeing, you know, sort of a 46 basis point rise in mortgage arrears in a single quarter, despite the fact that we're seeing mortgage deferrals, is, you know, sort of quite a sizable jump.
Well, yeah, and of course my mortgage stress data, which is a very early indicator of potential defaults later, has been rising quite fast. And I've taken account in that mortgage stress data of all of the supports that are there, which is why I say that actually I don't think JobKeeper is as widely supporting households as perhaps some think, but nevertheless it's a considerable number. But there are many people who are really caught with their mortgage repayments, and you know, their financial flows are looking pretty sick. And I'm also just been doing some analysis for the AFR actually on investor mortgages, which I won't go through into detail at the moment, but it's quite interesting looking at investor properties. and how many of them are also being caught by some of these flows. For example, suddenly their tenants are not paying their rent because they can't afford to, because guess what? They're not working. So whichever way you look at it, there are a lot of factors that suggest to me that the next 2 to 3 months, and particularly the September-October timeframe, will be the critical point to determine how serious this is. And I know that the Treasury is now saying, well, maybe unemployment will only go to 8% rather than 10%. Well, that, of course, is adjusted for the people who are on JobKeeper. But my view is if you take JobKeeper away, you probably should expect to see the unemployment rate go up again.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, I think we're probably more likely going to see some unemployment rest somewhere around about 10%, because we have no idea how many people are being supported by JobKeeper. And if it's anywhere near the number that the Grattan Institute suggested, which is sort of somewhere between 40 and 60% of people being affected by this, then it's going to be, you know, a rather substantial jump when JobKeeper does finally end. And I think you make a good point talking about like sort of that time that's coming in the fiscal cliff in September, October, because there's also renters. That's something that's really quite overlooked in all of this that you've been talking about in your videos on rental stress. Yep. Because there are a lot of people who have been paying either 50% rent or some sort of discount, or they haven't been paying their rent at all. And, you know, there's this sort of, you know, landlords are going to want that money. It's not just going to go away. That money isn't just going to be forgiven. You know, they're going to be chased for that money. And, you know, we're going to see, you know, people being dragged through the courts. You know, the end of the eviction ban is coming as well. And it's going to be, you know, quite a sizable problem, because all of a sudden, all of these people are going to have to start paying their full rents again. And I'm not entirely certain that a lot of them are going to be able to afford it, particularly if they continue to have lower hours, or if one person in a household has lost a job and they're not going to get that job back once JobKeeper ends.
Mm. Well, there's an interesting question, and you're right to underscore it. Those people who've had a rental reduction or a rental holiday, right? What happens when the rents do start again? Are they going to be required to pay what they missed paying? In other words, it's not really a holiday, it's just a postponement, or is it a real holiday? And certainly I've had a few people write to me, say, look, I'm in rented situation, and at the moment I've had a deferral of my rental payments, but it's only a deferral. So when it starts up in September, I've got to find back rent. and so it's not necessarily solving the problem, it's just moving the problem. And I guess with a mortgage, at least you could potentially extend the length of the mortgage by 6 months so that effectively the payments aren't changed. But you can't do that with rent.
No, you can't. And unlike in the commercial sector, where we've seen, you know, sort of legislated requirements in terms of rent being deferred and also being forgiven, in the residential sector, we haven't seen that. It's sort of, you know, a bit of a wild west. You know, there's okay, you do have to pay the rent at some point, but there's no real sort of framework as to how that's going to occur. You're going to have to pay a little bit more or a lot more each week, depending on the term of your lease, or is it just going to be, oh, hey, I need that thousands upon thousands of dollars right now, and you need to pay it, or I'm going to evict you. And I really think there needs to be some sort of framework being put out there, but from the government, in the same way they did in the commercial sector, to be able to work out exactly how all this is going to transpire. Because if not, you're going to have the courts being clogged up for years with landlords seeking evictions, landlords seeking the back rent.
Well, of course, that's all a state issue, right, rather than the federal issue, because the rental regimes are actually a state-based set of regulatory controls. So it'll be interesting to see what variations there are. And there were some variations across the states around. So there were some support mechanisms put in place in some states, not other states. But as you say, it was all about bilateral arrangements between the landlord and the tenants. And they've got to sort of work that out. And if there's not a willingness on both sides to work it out, it could get quite nasty quite quickly. And the other thing, of course, is that quite a few landlords are grateful for any tenant at the moment, because the number of surplus rented accommodation is higher than it's been for a long, long time. So the listings have grown and grown. And the average rental is dropping as well. So it's not a good time to be a landlord with a vacant property. So complex, to put it mildly, in terms of how this is going to all work out. But I guess there's another point here as well. Again, ScoMo clearly said today, we are going to get the budget back in surplus, right? We're going to stop basically spending as much as we've been spending because it was an emergency. So there's clearly a swing back to standard doctrine, which is we aim for a balanced budget. We're going to, clamp down on things. So that's another indication, I think, that they're not going to do much in the way of broader support beyond September. Might be a little bit of targeted support. And you wonder what the influence of that will be more broadly on the economic momentum. So, for example, we know that some people have been a little bit more willing to spend at the shops in the last few weeks, particularly as some of the controls have come away, so people are a bit more free to move around. But if the financial flows that we're looking at are as severe as we think they may be, then I suspect a lot of people will go on strike again and not spend much at the shops, which then has its own impact on the economic cycle in September. And the final point here is, from my SME analysis, I know that quite a few business had a pipeline of work and a pipeline of repayments and payments that they were going to get for the work done over the last few months. But that's beginning now to tail away. And so quite a few SMEs have no forward order in August, September, October, November. So again, there's another down draft, as it were, on the SME sector as well. Not uniformly across everyone, but quite a few sectors. So, wherever you look, you see traps and bear traps.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's important to remember that on average, in terms of super withdrawals and stimulus measures, we've seen around about sort of $4.5 to $4.8 billion a week being injected into the economy since all this started back in March. And that's an absolutely enormous amount of money considering the size of our economy. It's something like, I think it's about over 12% of GDP in terms of, the ratio of stimulus. And it's just like, and not only that, but it's all being concentrated in terms of getting money into people's pockets. So it's like, really? Every month, you guys are putting out more money in stimulus than Rudd did with his $950 cash handouts in its entirety. Of course, it's going to be good for Jerry Harvey. Of course, it's going to be good for retail. You're throwing all this money at people, and then all of a sudden, we're going to get to September, and not only are you going to be taking money away from businesses and away from people on JobKeeper, but we're going to be taking it away from people on JobSeeker. We're going to be taking it away from people who are unemployed, of which there are around about somewhere between 1.6 and 1.7 million people, according to the latest figures from the Department of Social Services. And the ABS released more data today suggesting that the number of unemployed people is actually rising and not falling, despite the fact that we're reopening. And it just creates an absolutely horrible situation whereby all these people who are in need are going to go from being on $1,500 a fortnight on JobKeeper to being on $500 a fortnight or $550 a fortnight on Centrelink unemployment benefits. And it's like you said, I mean, we've been talking about this for a while now. You know, like the mainstream's been saying, oh, no, everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine. You know, ScoMo is going to build the bridge and he's going to get us to the other side. And we've been saying for a while now, no, he's going to resume his ideological priorities. And today, like as you said, we've seen that. And I think that's something that's really important to remember, is that even with ScoMo's job maker continuing to put two words into one, because apparently we're not intelligent enough to work out a two-word sentence, it's an announcement of $72 billion in infrastructure. At first glance, headline, fantastic. You know, we're improving water infrastructure, we're improving dams, electricity, all these things that Australia sorely needs. But then you read into it, only $1.5 billion of that is going to be in place anytime soon. The other $70.5 billion is waiting for government approval, which is going to take, as ScoMo says at the moment, 21 months. 20 versus a normal, I think he said, about 3.5 years, which is going to be really fantastic for all those people who are going to get jobs 21 months from now. But for the moment, it's not really all that helpful for the economy. You know, it's lovely in terms of the announcement effect. You know, ScoMo says this, but does something different. And not to go on too much of a little bit of a rant here, but in terms of the funding for the drought, there was meant to be $7 billion. So far, $2 billion have been actually handed out. In terms of funding for the bushfires, $2 billion was budgeted. Only a couple of hundred million has actually been paid out. So it's all just really, really nice announcements, but not a whole lot of actual spending. And I think that really plays into the whole balanced budget thing. You know, it's even very similar to the small, medium enterprise government-backed loans. They said, oh, yes, we're going to do $40 billion. At last count from the Australian Banking Association, I believe it was about $1.3 billion. And it's like, well, this is all going to be fantastic for the budget. You know, ScoMo and Frydenberg can do their victory lap and say, oh, look, we came in tens of billions of dollars under budget. Aren't we fantastic, superior economic managers?
Mm. Well, you know, I always say that talk is cheap, right? Talk is cheap. And I think the government is actually quite an expert at big talk. But when you actually say, well, so let's just see precisely where the beef is, let's actually see where the money's actually come through to, you know, you make an excellent point that quite often the talk and what happens is quite different, or as I would say from the banking world, words and figures differ, right? So what they say they're going to do and what actually transpires in terms of the value that's injected is quite different. And it's all about protecting the budget.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about the budget. It's all about the superior economic manager's narrative. And I will, you know, before I say this, a big pinch of salt. This is hearsay and rumor. I have not independently confirmed this, but from what I've heard from people, there are MPs within the coalition and even apparently cabinet ministers who believe that we've passed through the storm, that it's going to be plain sailing from here, that we've dodged the worst of it, that like every other time Australia has been in a crisis in the last three decades, we are going to emerge from this relatively unscathed. And there are people who truly believe that. And I think today's announcement from Morrison that we're moving back to balanced budgets, that we're making big ticket promises, but not really any real concrete commitments, just plays into that. It plays into that idea that they think we've beaten this and we haven't. You know, it's very easy to look at, you know, consumer confidence data or retail sales data. And I think the retail sales for May are going to be quite impressive and something for them to hang their hat on. And they're going to say, oh, look at all this. And I think there's going to be a lot of that in the next few weeks and months. And I think it's going to get a little bit insufferable, to be completely honest with you. There's going to be that message from the media and that message from the government. We've recovered. Everything's fine. Look at these fantastic retail sales results. That month on month, they're the best we've ever seen. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see that. And it's just a little bit painful, to be completely honest with you, because you see all these things deteriorating behind the scenes. You see the rising mortgage arrears. You see the deteriorating, you know, services indexes, manufacturing indexes, construction indexes. You know, you could go on. And it's all just masking that cliff that we've talked about in the past. And it's really quite unfortunate because I feel like the Australian people are being taken for a bit of a ride.
Well, I agree. And of course, the point here is you can have a big percentage drop over a month or two, right? But then from that low point, every time you go up, percentage wise, it looks quite impressive, right? Unless people say, hang on a moment, where were we before we started? And in fact, the government are quite expert at picking the starting point for when they project forward. So, you know, GDP will be very strong from this point forward after the next quarter, right? Or unemployment will look better. So you've got to be careful about where the baseline is. And I thought it was interesting that ScoMo was out there today at CEDA saying we're the third best in terms of the weakness of our GDP relative to everybody else, right? So, you know, a lot of other countries have got lots of problems, but no, we've actually done extremely well. So he was definitely patting himself on the back and patting the country on the back. And I just keep thinking, well, you know, it's okay, but it's way, way too soon. And the OECD last week, when they came out with their projections, said, you know, on a phase, assuming we don't get another wave, then the GDP looks pretty weak. If we get a second wave, which is quite possible and quite conceivable, then the GDP is much, much worse. I think that's a really important wake-up call, because I think that they've got a more objective view as to where our economy sits relative to the spin that's being thrown there at the moment.
Absolutely. And I think even just there's a great chart from the OECD of the projected decline of the global economy. It's going to be down something like, I think it was about 6%. Mm. And I think if you can find the chart, you should perhaps put it up there for the viewers, because you see the drop for the COVID outbreak and for this year, and it's about yay big. You see the drop for the GFC, it's about this big on the chart. And I think that's one thing that's really overlooked, one of the many things that's overlooked in the debate for Australia. We can't have a global economy that's tanking and expect us to somehow be immune to it, and also and all dance around our barbecues talking about our negatively geared investment property and rising housing prices.
We'd never do that, would we? No, you're right. And I'll put up the OECD. In fact, I'll put up the two versions of the global OECD. There's the one wave, and then there's the two wave one, right? And the two wave one, I think, is the one we should take the most notice of, because we've got evidence now in China, in South Korea, and a couple of other places that, in fact, there is a second wave. And of course, in the US, the first wave and the second wave is combined into one mega wave. So I think we have to assume that this is going to be a significant issue. And then, as you say, the economic fallout for us, because of the rest of the world is still locked down, even if we aren't, our trade is going to be affected. Students into Australia will be affected. And of course, the tourism sector, which is huge, will also be affected. So until the global situation calms down, it's going to be very tough for our economy to be able to battle through.
Absolutely. And I think you make an important point with the students as well, is because if we are seeing second waves and we are seeing all these issues arising in China and the US, and even some say that we may even start seeing some in Europe, is how many people, how many students are going to be willing to come to Australia where they were recently told to go home if they're going to be stuck here? If we open our borders next month and the international students flow back in, it's entirely possible that they could be stuck here for an indeterminate amount of time. I don't know about you, but if I had enough, you know, sort of uncertain finances, I wasn't sure if I could get my job when I came back, and all those various issues for a student, I think we really have to ask ourselves how many people are going to be willing to come back if they're going to be stuck here and not be able to get back to China or wherever they may be from towards the end of the year. And yet again, that's an issue that hasn't really been covered at all. Because, you know, we've got this sort of Australia-centric, Australian exceptionalism narrative where we're fantastic, the rest of the world sucks, but somehow we're going to get through this completely unscathed, even as the rest of the world tanks. And, you know, I found on Twitter the other day, I saw, you know, someone retweeted an article by Christopher Joy saying that everything was, you know, sort of going to be moderate or, you know, sort of non-existent in terms of housing price drops. And then there was a post from a European economist showing a chart of US and EU GDP forecasts from Deutsche Bank and the EU Commission. And they both predicting that their respective economies aren't going to recover until 2023. And meanwhile, we're sitting here, you know, sort of firing up the barbie for, you know, a productive auction season.
Well, we are in a little bubble territory, right? Because, you know, Australia's a long way from anywhere. But I think reality will dawn. And for me, the key thing to look at will be hours worked, right? I think that's going to be a much better indicator than almost any other measure that's officially produced, because the employment numbers will be typically weird because of all the things that have gone on. But we should keep a track on hours worked. If those hours worked stay below where they were before this thing started, we know we'll have a long-term problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really quite fascinating watching all of this unfold, you know, seeing all the various different little bits of data and seeing the slow deterioration. And I think that's, as you say, with the hours worked, we're going to see this slow grind down, because I don't think that we're going to see this sort of big drop off at the moment, because we have JobKeeper, we have all these other different things supporting our economy. And I think that also makes comparisons with other countries difficult, because other nations, they don't have JobKeeper. It's all well and good for, you know, for ScoMo to get up there and do his flag waving and wave around these bits of coal, but at the end of the day, it's not an apt comparison. Other countries don't have what we have. But then when September comes, then we can start, the end of September comes, and sort of into October, then we can start talking about exactly how we stack up with the rest of the world. And frankly, considering the sort of moderate experience we've had with the virus, we should be doing a lot better in our economy. And if we're in a position where we're not, then I think that more needs to be done on the stimulus side, more needs to be done to create jobs. And to be completely frank, I really do think that we need a sort of national discussion about that. You know, we need industry leaders and social services groups and all these various different stakeholders to come together to work out exactly what we need. Because at the moment, I'm really quite concerned that everything that we're seeing is just sort of ideological window dressing, that we're just going to sort of believe the hype and then potentially head off the cliff. I mean, I hope not, but we'll see.
Well, I'm minded of Warren Buffett, who said famously that you can see who's swimming naked when the tide goes out, right? And my view is the tide will be out the end of September, and then we will actually be able to see what's really going on, because at the moment the tide is in, and therefore a lot of what the real story is being submerged in all this media spin and political spin and job keeper and job seeker and all those things. But that's all artificial. So when the tide goes out end of September, then we will know. And I suspect that the news probably will be less good than many people will be expecting.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. But I think there is one important caveat to all these things that we're talking about, is that there is the fiscal headroom to kick the can down the road for quite a long time if they choose to. You know, I mean, we're only in about sort of 45% of percent of GDP in government debt. And if they chose to sort of throw another $100 billion at the economy every year for the next 5 years, or $150 billion, it's doable. It's absolutely doable. It's the issue is political will and naturally the global credit markets. If the Fed can keep a lid on things, which is, well, who knows exactly how that's going to end, but if they can keep a lid on things in terms of borrowing costs and in terms of, you know, sort of systemic risk, you know, the Morrison government could kick the can down the road. But the question is, will they? And I think that we're seeing today that the answer is most likely no. But I think there's always that potential that perhaps down the road they just go, oh, crap. You know, we've seen what's happened in America. They've turned off their unemployment benefits. It's a complete disaster. Sorry, supplemental unemployment benefits. And it's a disaster. And I think that's something that needs to be sort of considered to some sort of degree, because there is that potential that they're just going to panic, that they're just going to throw more money at the economy because they don't want to be remembered as the people who crashed the Australian economy into a tree when it didn't need to be.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I mean, they demonstrated their appetite for doing that, as they did at the start of this crisis. And some would argue that maybe they threw too much too soon, but that's a different story, I guess. But it's down to an ideological battle. I can't read which way it's going to go at the moment. My worry is that they will wait until September and then panic. And as you say, then perhaps actually go too far the other way. Because what I don't see really is good strategic thinking. And, you know, strategic thinking not over just a few months or over the election cycle, but a strategy that's actually there for the next 5 or even 10 years. Because that's, I think, the time horizon over which we should be thinking about how to steer the economy and craft a better future. And you know, there is an opportunity if people did but see it. But no, I think we're going to go the short term. We will cut and then we may have to throw some more money on the Barbie later.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that looking even at this job maker plan with all this various infrastructure they're talking about, very little of this, only sort of $1.5 billion is actually shovel ready to go tomorrow. You know, they're talking, when they say fast track, they don't mean, oh, we're going to build it all twice as fast. What they mean is we're going to approve it twice as fast. And I think it's quite telling that there isn't a plan. That there isn't a draw somewhere in Treasury where all of these various infrastructure projects have been approved but are waiting on funding, you know, sort of waiting for that just-in-case moment to come. And I think that's something that the government really should have been better prepared for. You know, there should always be a plan. I mean, the Americans back in the 1930s had a plan to go to war with Australia and the British Empire, just in case it happened, even though it was an extremely unlikely outcome. But, you know, I mean, the chances of another global financial crisis you know, sort of after 2008, was always there. There was always that potential. And instead, we're talking about building Snowy Hydro 2.0, which was being discussed when Malcolm Turnbull was Prime Minister, which was quite a while ago now. And now they're talking about getting the approvals done in under 2 years. Now, that you know, don't get me wrong, it's great that we're building infrastructure, but by the same token, we're building infrastructure 2 years from now, more or less. You know, that's basically the rest of the election cycle. And one thing I like about this, just from a political perspective, is that if they have an election in, say, March 2022, they can walk away from all of this, the coalition. They can just say, oh, yeah, this is all on the books. This is all going to be budgeted for. And then if Labor wins the election, they can turn around 5 years from now and say, look at Labor's debt. Look at Labor's debt. Look at what they've done again, even though they're the ones who've legislated it, because that's just the way politics works. You know, it's not fair. It's not nice. But, it's almost perfect that it's just that timeline is just perfectly booby-trapped for the next government to cop it, whoever that government is.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the truth of the matter is that politics comes first, the economy comes second, and I guess ordinary people come third. That's the relative priority, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, it does seem like it's like that all too often. And I think that's what people need to realise as well, is that even, say, for example, with the discussion about property, you know, people say, you know, that a lot of people are saying, oh, the reason why it won't fall is because the government will support it. And yes, that's absolutely true to a degree. But what we've seen today, and as you're saying about Morrison resuming his ideological priorities of a balanced budget, there are going to be other stakeholders who are going to be, you know, crying out for support in the coming months and years, because, you know, as we've discussed, you're not immune to the issues in the global economy. And the property industry and the housing price brokers are going to have to compete with, you know, with productive industry, with manufacturing, with retail, with all these various different industries, all of whom carry a fair bit of weight with the Liberal Party room. And, you know, I wouldn't be betting the farm on that.
I agree. Well, look, it's been great catching up once again and getting your read on what's going on. Lots of uncertainties ahead. Watch for the end of September, and I guess we should catch up again just a few weeks down the crack and see how things are playing out.
Yep, sounds good. I'm looking forward to it.
Good to talk to you once again. Thanks for that.